just to kind of do levels, if you could, give me a name and kind of association title.
Okay, my name's David Spiegelhalter. I'm the Winton Professor of or for the Public Understanding of Risk, and I'm never quite sure which, and I'm here in the Stats Lab in Cambridge University.
Okay, could you tell me, say, what you had for breakfast today?
Interesting. I knew I was going to be asked that, so I made sure I had a healthy breakfast of muesli. And a sausage.
So no fry up today.
No, I had a sausage. I couldn't resist the sausage. But no bacon sandwich.
Okay. I'm here to talk to you about, you're a professor for the Public Understanding.
Oh, sorry, can I?
Yes.
Are you going to be in it, or do you want me to repeat the question?
Oh, no, I will. I'm clearly being picked up. My voice will be.
Be in it. Oh,
yes.
Cool, fine. So I don't have to say, I am doing this because, I don't know.
I am.
It is a conversation. Good.
Yes, I am egotistical enough to
excellent.
Not
much,
want to
much
remove
easier,
my voice.
Much easier. Much rather do it as a conversation, one of these fake.
Definitely conversational. Yeah. So, you're the professor for the Public Understanding of Risk, or for Risk, or whatever it is. So I was wondering if you could just give a little, pressy, perhaps, of what risk actually is, because the mathematical idea of risk is a little bit different than what a lot of people might think of when they hear the word.
Yeah, I'm Professor of,
yeah,
or maybe for, the Public Understanding of Risk. I suppose the crucial thing is I don't actually study, I'm not an academic of the Public Understanding of Risk, although we are writing some academic papers. Basically, I'm interested in the outreach, the engagement, the communication activities. And although the job's called risk, this word means almost anything to everybody. Well, people say, oh, you do risk, you can come and talk to us about pensions. Or, you do risk, you can come and talk to us about volcanoes or something like that. Now, I am struggling to understand a bit about pensions and volcanoes, but when I got the job, I had no idea whatsoever. The point is, the word means absolutely everything to everybody. So I deliberately do not give it a technical definition. I don't try to define it mathematically. I treat it purely as meaning when you're in a situation where you don't know what's going to happen, and some of the outcomes may be good and some of them might be bad. So our website is called Understanding Uncertainty, because I feel that uncertainty is a less sort of value-laden thing than risk. Everyone assumes, as soon as they hear risk, in this country they think of health and safety and trying to protect children and the whole business of can we reduce risk. I'm not actually interested very much in reducing risk. I couldn't care less what people do with their with their shabby little lives. If they want to drink and smoke themselves to death, that's completely up to them. But I do feel that people should understand the consequences of their actions, whether they're going for good things like buying lottery tickets, or whether they're going for bad things like smoking some, whatever, or taking drugs. So I view it as something, any situation where you don't know what's going to happen, and things maybe turn out well, or they may turn out badly. And that's what I do. And that is beautiful, because it just covers absolutely everything. But as you said, I work in a maths department. I work in a pure maths department. Can you believe it? What am I doing here? But I started off as a mathematician, and I am a professional statistician. So I definitely came at this job with a very numerical, mathematical sense. I thought, let's measure risk, let's put numbers on it, let's weigh things up, do a proper sort of, economic models for things. And I suppose in the few years I've had this job, I'm tending away from that perspective rather strongly. It's a sort of bad crowd I've got into. I spend my time now talking to psychologists, anthropologists, sociologists, etc., who hear this sort of numerical stuff and sneer at it. And I was really upset at first, but then I started listening to them, particularly geographers. In this university, are really, really good at looking at the way society deals with risk and realise it's not just a matter of trying to work out the numbers and then telling people what to do and telling people, you don't handle risk very well. So I've gone from thinking, people are so bad at risk, I need to tell them what to do, to thinking, actually, maybe people aren't so bad at it, even though they're not using the numbers. And this is definitely a two-way communication. I need to try to understand what people feel, what they understand. And then maybe, through having some mathematical insights, I can contribute to the debate. But I've definitely changed my perspective on this.
Even though you're trying to stay away perhaps from a very strict definition, and I will not push you into demanding that you give me one, but What are the kind of mathematical things you can do in order to better understand this idea of uncertainty or this idea of risk?
Yeah, I mean, I really believe you know the mathematics is absolutely crucial, absolutely vital. What I don't believe is that it is everything. So my feeling is that you need to push the quantification as far as you possibly can, but no further, and realize that there will always be stuff that does not fit within that mathematical framework. That's really important. So I is just getting that balance. So I think, yeah, you do need the maths, and that's why I'm very interested in education within mathematics, actually even broader than just mathematics in schools, so that kids, you know, can realize there is a way to sit back and think about risky problems. You know, I just use this sociological term of deconstruction, but when you hear somebody telling you something like, oh, you shouldn't smoke, or don't do this, don't do that, invest this, buy this, don't do that, you can say, oh, hang on, you know, why not? Let's take this apart. Every risk story, listening to the radio this morning, there was some usual risk story about something or other and how you shouldn't do it. I forgot what the latest one was. I was shouting. Every morning I shout at the radio and say, ask him what the risks are. What's going on? What actually, you know, at the moment in this country, they're all discussing about border controls. Nobody deconstructs it. How many terrorists are being let in? Someone can estimate. What are the risks? Unacceptable breaches in security. How do they know? Come on, someone put some numbers on this stuff. Let's take this story apart. So that's what I feel very strongly about, and how we need to really do something about the education for deconstructing risks.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of something I would cover with students back when I was teaching math. We would cover a little bit of probability, and I would go in and talk about the data mining that the U.S. did after 9/11. Which is an example Bruce Schneier really likes to talk about, how no matter how good the algorithm was to find the terrorists, even if it found every terrorist with 100%, it found so many people that weren't terrorists.
Yeah. Well, the analogy I always used is, if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, there's a lot of bits of straw that look like needles. It's going to take you a long time. And it's the same thing holds for breast screening and any sort of way, you know, as why so much health screening is not actually worthwhile doing. And so, you know, it's a really valuable structure. And that's one of the things we're trying to get into schools to, which is, of course, teaching about conditional probability, actually Bayes' theorem. You don't have to call it that. There's all sorts of ways to deconstruct that and to make it much clearer to people. Generally, the way these things are taught is very unclear. And so one of the interesting things, of course, is that we're talking about education in schools, how important that is. But there's enormous interest now in educating people using transparent means about what the risks they face. The point is that, particularly in health, you, me, everybody are really badly served by those, the great and the good, in telling us about what the effects of drugs might be, you know, what the effects of screening, what the benefits of screening might be, etc., etc. We're very badly served. It's almost deliberately obscure, you might think, the ways in which things are communicated. 30% increased risk of something or other, this will save 10,000 lives. All these different units being used in a very confusing way. Often the information just not available. And so there's a big move in the US and the UK towards what we might call transparent communication of the risks and benefits of health interventions. And you know, I now talk to people in the economic world and finance world and pension world saying, well, hang on, can't we use some of these ideas in talking about people about financial risks? That, you know, there are better way we can learn from psychological experiments, a lot of research in the last 20 years, a huge amount of work has been done on better ways, transparent ways to communicate risks to people. And that largely means using whole numbers, or at least percentages, maybe just whole numbers out of 1,000 people, this is what we expect to happen, and so on and so on, doing things in a balanced way, not just talking about the risks, talking about the harms on equal weighting, using graphics, vivid graphics, showing little people stacked up, and all this kind of stuff. Looks like, you know, people look at it and say, oh, this is like child's things. Well, exactly, because some of the best communication devices has been in children's education.
Do you have a couple of concrete examples of what you're talking about, of how these risks, especially in, say, the medical field or finance, are being poorly communicated?
Well, one of the classic examples is in talking about the benefits of drugs. You know, I'm in my 50s, I could take statins to try to reduce the risk of heart attack or stroke. My risk for the next 10 years of heart attack or stroke is about 12, 13%, something like that, and I could probably reduce it by a third if I took statins. Now, the standard drug advert, and particularly in the US, where, of course, they can do direct-to-consumer drug advertising, talks about cut your risk by a third, take statins, blah, blah, blah. You know, I won't mention the trade names, but that's what they say. And so, and then down in the print, the tiny print at the bottom, it says, this will reduce your five-year risk from 3% to 2%. Now, hang on, you do the sums, that means that over 5 years is reducing your absolute risk just by 1%. That means 100 people are taking these drugs for 5 years with all the side effects. It's going to prevent one heart attack. Now, maybe that's worthwhile. Maybe you consider that's worthwhile. I actually don't consider it worthwhile. I'm not going to take them. So, but, you know, where is that information being communicated? Both about the transparent communication about the side effects, the communication about the absolute risks, rather than the relative risks. Now, I have to say, the people have been going on about this for some time. The ABPI, which is the professional body for the pharmaceutical industry in this country, their new code of practice this year bans the use of just using relative risks. They explicitly say if you can use relative risk, like 30% reduction, you must provide absolute risks. What they don't say is it has to be in the same size font. But it's a step in the right direction. And of course, you can't do direct-to-consumer advertising here anyway. So it's that kind of issue that people are pushing very strongly. The next stage, of course, is to get balanced communication of harms and benefits. So the benefits in terms of reducing heart attacks are communicated in exactly the same scale and representation as the possible harms, the possible side effects. And that's the next stage, which is being pushed strongly in the US with the trying to get the FDA. FDA's risk communication panel is fantastic. They really are excellent, the sort of stuff they're trying to push. Whether they'll succeed in what they're trying to do is another matter. But it's a really exciting time, and I think we're going to see a lot of change in the way these ideas are communicated in the future.
Now, you've mentioned trying to push this a little bit more in schools. How do you see schools right now teaching this? Is it, you know, not at all, or is it just poorly done?
Probability teaching in schools, I think it must vary a lot. And there are certain things that I really like. I think the use of probability trees, for example, is absolutely excellent. And I try to use it in all my talks to schools to show this fantastic tool of a probability tree. It's just as tremendous. I feel sorry for people who have to teach permutations and combinations because I find it unbelievably dull and confusing. And of course, a lot of the teaching is rooted in games, you know, dice and cards and pulling socks out of drawers and that stuff, which is fine to start with, but gets a bit dull, I think. So though in the UK they're starting to develop some risk type questions for teaching, to be honest, they're all basically about expectation. Rather disparagingly called the washing machine warranty type question. You know, you've got so many will fail, how much do you pay, and what's the expected gain, and that sort of stuff. Which, of course, is not daft, because one of the biggest cons in the whole of society are extended warranties on white goods and electronics. I mean, that's where the people make all their money from. The biggest con used to be travel insurance sold by travel agents. I think people have tended to catch on to that now. So now the biggest con in the whole of society are extended warranties. So, you know, it is good that people understand that they're being ripped off, maybe, on this. So understanding how warranties work is, of course, important. But they're pretty dull questions on the whole. And I think certainly my sort of school's engagement, engaging with issues in the broader world about the risks that kids face, you know, rooting things in more practical problems, is more interesting. I also think that ways of communicating probability away from just thinking of it as perhaps a decimal or even a fraction, but to think of it as what you might expect to happen to 1,000 people can make some problems enormously easier to solve. It makes conditional probability incredibly easier to define and use if you think of it in terms of frequent natural frequencies. So there are various, you know, the language and the metaphors are very important, and also I think the examples that one uses are important.
Do you have favorite examples that you like to bring in when you give talks to
Students. Well, I'm really lucky because when I'm talking to schools, and I do a lot of school stuff, and I love doing it. I really love doing it, both in small groups, you know, getting just 15 or 20, 13, 14 year olds doing exercises in the class and talking and exchanging is really fun. With small groups, I love doing coincidences and things like that. I mean, obviously, the standard one of 23 people to go up more than half birthday, but you can use smaller ones like any 7. You know, there's 50% chance I'll show a birthday. So you can you share a birthday within a week or so. And so you can do various things with that. And you get them to flip coins and things like... the one that seems to go down well is one of the most basic ones is trying to tell a sequence of coin flips, whether it's real or fake. You get someone to make one up and then actually do one. And then write on the back of the sheet of paper whether it's real or fake, then pass it to the next table and they have to guess which is which. It's a really nice competition. And then somebody, you know, bright spark comes out, hanging, you know, well, it's you get long sequences and not so many switches in the real ones, and you know, I show some simulations and things like that, and then after that they pretty well get them all right. So that, I mean, that's quite a fun one. Coincidences always goes down well, and there's various coincidence ones you can do, which are for smaller groups that don't involve birthdays. One of the ones I like is it's not, you know, I haven't seen people use this so much. If you get if you've got 20 kids and they all choose a number at random between 1 and 100, there's 87% chance two of them will choose the same number. Now, that's quite unintuitive. It's even higher than that because people are hopeless at choosing numbers at random. So, you know, they don't choose numbers ending in zeros, they choose odd numbers more than even. So the chances are even higher. So they're always two of them will pick the same number. Even when they start learning not to choose 66 and 99, they'll still choose... I think they do it again and again, and you say, okay, pick them out of 200, and they pick the two and pick the same number. And, it's like, whoa, it's really magic. And for the better classes, you can start doing some of the maths out of it. You know, there's a really nice formula that tells you, no matter how big the class is, you can tell them what the range is to give this 87%, which is 1 minus 1 over e squared. So it's... I like those for small groups, but some of the stuff we do... I mean, in the UK, we're really blessed with some great organisations that organise sort of maths events, maths inspiration and maths in action, both of whom I work for. And they put on a day or an afternoon or a day of maths, entertaining maths talks. And and we'll get 500 or even 800 kids at a time into big theatres. And you've got to entertain 800 kids for 40 minutes on probability. Well, you know, that can be a bit challenging, but I got a string of jokes and stories and news stories and things like that. But even so, you can still get people to do stuff even in the class. I think that's really cool. But again, that's being really privileged, not having to teach to a syllabus. You can just do fun things. Yeah.
So moving back a little bit to the risk thing, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about, say, the wonderful vocabulary that surrounds the mathematical study of risk. One specific term, which is my favorite mathematical measure term, I believe, which is the micromort.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay,
which is such a wonderful term. I wonder if you could perhaps give me a definition for what it is, and then maybe give a couple examples of things that have been measured in micromorts.
I wish I'd made it up. It was Ron Howard in Stanford in the 1970s made it up. A micromort is a 1 in a million chance of sudden death. That's actually accidental death, or, you know, really sudden death. So, and he used to, apparently, it's rumoured that he worked out that it was so many micromorts every time he flew, and he was willing to be paid so much to take on this micromort. So when he put in his consultancy fees, he'd charge per hour, but he'd also add on for how many micromorts he'd experienced in doing the consultancy. I think it's so cool. So I think I'm going to charge for it. And in fact, of course, it does go into my thinking now. If I have to drive to give a talk, I'm much more reluctant to give a talk if I have to drive. I've become actually rather conscious of this stuff. I really don't like driving now. I quite enjoy it, but I really try to cut down on driving and take the train because it is so much safer. So I have become more conscious because of it. Anyway, micromort, 1 in a million chance of sudden death. It's a great unit, and I find it goes down. From small kids to radio presenters, all love it because suddenly it provides a whole number unit. The crucial thing then you can work in whole numbers. No fractions, no decimals, no per something or other. It's a whole number, and it allows you to make comparisons across a wide range of activities, from taking illegal drugs to going horse riding. There was a big fuss in this country last year when the head of the drug advisory board got sacked because he was making comparisons between taking ecstasy and what he called the addiction to horse riding, which was equacy. And he said, they're about as dangerous. Horse riding and ecstasy, it's a toss-up, they're about as dangerous. And he got into such trouble for this, you know, outraged, you know, politicians. How can you compare the two? Well, of course you can compare the two. It's a fantastic comparison. These are both voluntary activities taken for fun by young people. Okay, one is wholesome horse riding in the countryside, and the other is not wholesome, which is popping pills in some club and dancing all the time. So, but they're still, you know, they really are very broadly comparable, except one you wear a crash helmet, one you don't. So I thought this was a fantastic comparison. So I now, you know, compare heroin with hang gliding. You know, I take every opportunity to make completely inappropriate comparisons. So the micromort, it's a one in a million. Why it's quite a good unit is that in this country anyway, 50 people die sudden deaths every day. They're murdered or they run over or the satellite falls on their head, or actually that hasn't happened, but it will one day. I could tell you how many micromorts that is. So 50 a day, I'd have about 50 million people. So, you know, on average, we wandering around are exposed about one micromort a day, some more than others, depending on their life. And we seem to be happy with this. So as a unit of risk, one in a million chance is sort of small enough to be noticed, but, you know, or big enough to be noticed, but small enough so that we don't actually care too much about it. So it's a good unit. Now, so one, your micromort, on average in this country, that means you can drive about 250 miles for a micromort, walk about 20 miles, about 6 miles on a motorbike. You can go hang gliding, which is about 8 micromorts. Skydiving, I'm using actually US data, skydiving is 7 micromorts a dive, and people do lots of them. And, you know, the US site is very good about how many people smack into the ground every year. And we know how many dives there are. So it's 7 micromorts. Scuba diving, 5 micromorts a dive. They're very reliable from over time, that one's been. So, again, these are averages, but they provide a nice comparison. Then you're going to have an anaesthetic. Emergency is about 10, an ordinary anaesthetic is about 5. That's the anaesthetic, not the operation. Giving birth, about 80 in this country, more in the US on average. It'll vary, of course, hugely in the US. And of course, thousands and thousands in some other countries. So it enables you, taking ecstasy, about 1 every time. Heroin is about 30 a day, just from being a heroin user. Serving in Afghanistan for the UK troops, at the peak, it was about 30 a day. That's about 200 miles on a motorbike for all thousands of people serving in Afghanistan. So, you know, this is high risk stuff. Being in the UK bomber force, in the British bomber force in the Second World War, was 1 micromort a second. I don't think anyone has ever done anything, apart from being an officer in the First World War, of such sustained danger, I think, as being in a bomber in the Second World War. Unbelievable. So, you can make these comparisons between everyday and not such everyday activities.
So you mentioned that horse riding and ecstasy are about the same, except one had a crash helmet. If an ecstasy user wore a crash helmet, how would that change?
No, probably not much, because actually, a lot of that will be, not through dehydration, but through drinking too much water, other things, and it's so mixed up with the drink and other drugs as well. So actually separating out ecstasy itself is really quite tricky. So some of them will probably fall over as well, but that's probably not the main cause of death.
Okay, fair enough with that. You mentioned that you've become quite conscious of this, and you gave some of the stats for, say, transportation. You said you like to now take the train more than like to drive because of this. But if things on the internet are to be believed, and they're not always to be believed, but you did mention that you bike to work today. Now, biking is less or is has more micromorts associated for shorter distances than driving a car.
About 10 times.
So, since you are conscious of this, why now do you decide to bike instead of drive to work?
This is the wonderful issue, which we're really dealing with at the moment, is the trade-off between acute and chronic risk, which is what you're talking about, in fact. The fact that you might do some things like biking to work, especially there's one junction between work and here, which is dangerous. And especially as I'm a really dopey cyclist, I'm going along, tweeting, you know, my head all over the place. I'm thinking about work, I'm thinking about all sorts of stuff. And I have to go past this really junction where I know people have been knocked over. Cambridge academics have quite a record of being knocked off bicycles because they're so dopey. So it's really, I've got to be very careful. But I'd so much rather cycle than drive, both because it's aesthetically more pleasant, it's a much better way, it's actually quicker in time, and, you know, I now try to look after my health. You know, I had a healthy breakfast, for heaven's sake. So I try to get exercise, I really do, because this is to do with chronic risk, which, in other words, trying to live a healthier life. So the point is that you've got two types, you know, there's risk that can kill you now, but I could also be sitting here eating a pork pie, smoking cigarettes and being a complete slob, and that's not actually probably not going to kill me today unless I choke on my pork pie or fall through the sofa or something, but it's not going to do me much good in the future. We've in fact, and this is our idea, have developing this new unit which I'm testing called a micro life. Now, a micro life is what we're calling 30 minutes off your life expectancy, the length of your life. Now, why we call it a micro life, the 1.5 million hours is 57 years, which, you know, so you're talking to a young adult in their mid-20s, their life expectancy is about another 57 years. So it's the length of your sort of adult life, thinking of adults from as mid-20s, when people are starting to think about this stuff, maybe a bit more. And so 30 minutes off your life. So you know, simple calculations. Smoking 2 cigarettes is 1 microlife. Is 30 minutes off the length of your life, but slightly longer than it takes you to smoke the cigarette. A few drinks is a microlife, so that's probably about the time it takes you to drink the drinks. And being overweight, I'm 5 kilograms overweight, and that's about 1 microlife a day. So I'm using that up, but so I'm trying to counteract that by, you know, taking a bit more exercise and eating healthily. So and these are quite interesting. So it's changing the metaphor from immediate risk, which isn't appropriate, to one in which the speed at which you're living your life. Now, it's been found in terms of changing people's behaviour that metaphor can be quite useful. It's been found that telling people, for example, smokers their lung age is quite useful. You know, their lungs are ageing faster than they are. They've got the lungs of someone who's 20 years old or something like that. I'm working on things with the cardiovascular groups on heart age, which is now being used by a number of places around the world to communicate to people that they're damaging their heart by their lifestyle. You know, you're 45, but your heart is 50. Is that of a 55-year-old? Quite a powerful image, and it's to do, instead of saying, oh, you'll live, instead of, you know, dying at 90, you might die at 92 if you do this, which frankly, you know, isn't going to impress anyone, particularly young people. For goodness sake, who cares? There's a lovely quote that I use from a popular newspaper, The Sun, which it was in this debate about bacon sandwiches that I'd been involved in. So, and a doctor wrote, I'd rather have the occasional bacon sandwich than be 110 and be dribbling into my Albran. Which I thought, yes, he's right. So talking about living a bit longer at the end of your life is not a great metaphor for actually communicating to people the impact of what they're doing. The idea of living your life faster, in other words, rushing towards your death, is quite a powerful metaphor. Again, not that I care what they do, but you know, people should be aware of those consequences. One of the interesting things mathematically is that your death is moving away from you. Life expectancy in this country is increasing by 3 months a year. It's of course increased by 6 years over the last 25 years. So every year you live, in fact, your death is moving 3 months away. So you could say you're only living, aging 9 months a year. So every day, it's at that sort of 48 microlives that you're working yourself through. But you could say that medical advances are handing back 12 to you as a bonus.
And with that, you can do all those other things.
Oh, yeah.
Things.
No, and, then and, I can, and, exactly. Yeah. Then I can buy
so pork then you age 1 year
well,
a year.
Well, exactly. But this is the idea that if... Okay, I'm going to eat and drink myself into a stupor because medical science will take care of me. By that time, they'll have found out the cure for being a complete slob. This is a high-risk option.
Trying to figure out the right way to phrase this. What kind of importance does proper knowledge of risk or proper knowledge of uncertainty, to use the term from your website, how would that help your normal citizen, your person on the street?
I think in many ways not at all. I mean, I always think that people have been around for quite a long time. Probability theory hasn't. It's a real Johnny-come-lately. It's unbelievable. It's, 1660s, really, it was developed. It's only been around for a little while. The idea of rational economic decision-making, although Daniel Bernoulli was talking about that in the beginning of the 18th century, is very recent indeed. And so it really irritates me when economists and other statisticians start wagging their finger at the general public and saying how irrational they are because they're not obeying the rules of expected utility. Absolute. Oh no, I better not use a rude word. Okay, to use an English phrase, it's absolute bollocks. Are they saying that before 1660 everybody was irrational and stupid just because they didn't use expected utility? It's all nonsense. How dare they? It's so arrogant to think that somehow people are being irrational because they're not using probability and weighing up everything in a numerical sense. It's absolute nonsense. People have always managed very well. They've gambled for years. Now, okay, some of the gambling wasn't great, maybe.
Cardano.
Yeah. And some of the developed annuities and things like that was really bad because that when they started doing that, then they clearly needed some analytic capacity. But people have made decisions in the face of uncertainty for a long time. And, as all the work that's been going on has shown that generally people use a lot of shortcuts, heuristics, which, you might call them biases. I prefer calling them rules of thumb, which work really well most of the time. However, as Kahneman, Tversky and others have shown, there are certain situations in which people can be really misled by these heuristics. Framing, the way the question is framed, is a classic one. You can just get people to say whatever you want, essentially, by framing the question a different way. The way that numbers are framed has been shown to be can be very influential. So I think people are just great. I love them. But they have to watch out for when people are trying to manipulate them. People are trying to flog them gambles, or money things. People are actually trying to flog them gambles, like the absolutely crummy lottery that's just started off in this country. Terrible. And newspapers, when they're trying to sell them risk stories. Politicians, when they're trying to say, you've got to be concerned about this, that, and the other. Well, why should I be concerned about this? In those situations where people are trying to manipulate you to think one thing or the other, which is happening all the time in every newspaper story, every time you open a news bulletin, you really need to be able to take those numbers apart. And people are using evidence. Either if they're not using numbers, you should be asking why not, and if they are using numbers, you should say I don't believe them, or at least I don't believe the way you're necessarily believe the way you're telling me about them, and I want to be able to look at these things. I want them communicated in a transparent way. So I'm really, really interested in that. So one of the things we're doing, of course, is training journalists. Now, I work with journalists, increasingly work with journalists, partly because I absolutely love trying to tear their stories apart if I can, but now increasingly I'm sort of going a bit native. I'm either getting quoted in stories or we're with the Royal Statistical Society and Science Media Centre developing more journalist training in statistics and risk, which is, there's a big demand for it. There's a very big demand for it.
So in the world today, which is it being increasingly mediafied, you're getting these things shoved in your face constantly. Do you think this being this ability to kind of understand risk in this way of being able to go through stories and identify when people are either lying to you or trying to manipulate you, do you think that is something that is going to be increasingly important as our world kind of gets smaller and faster in this media saturation?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm a big supporter of the sort of blogging community, the critical, what I've got, the numerical critical community. And I just think it's wonderful that some politician comes up with a number now, and in the past, people just, oh, yeah, that must be right. Now, you know, it's absolute all hell breaks loose on the internet and the blogs, which is starting to penetrate the mainstream media more, because people take these numbers apart. There's loads of, you know, both sort of semi-professional, professional and amateur bloggers who will take these things apart now. It's absolutely great. And that's encouraged, of course, by open data and et cetera, et cetera. Now, I suppose I'm thinking is, I'm interested in almost the next stage beyond just the openness in the data and being able to make comparisons and draw graphs and infographics, which I love. I love all that stuff. But really the next stage beyond that is what we might call some more inferential ideas of, okay, here are some numbers. What are they actually, and it's great being able to see the numbers for once and being able to plot them and actually make comparisons. What do they actually mean? I was so impressed recently. There's a lovely story of someone claiming bowel cancer rates were 3 times as high in one area of the country than another. And a blogger just took the data and showed that this is entirely explainable by chance. You know, this is just random variation, which people have been doing for 100 years. But he just did a nice plot, put it out there, got covered in some national coverage. And I thought, yes, this is absolutely fantastic work. But it's not just getting the data. He scraped the data off the web. It's a big effort. It wasn't just getting the data. It wasn't just plotting it, but it was plotting it in a way that allows you to really draw a strong conclusion that the sort of story was absolute nonsense. It was just chance variability. So I think that required a couple of things. You know, the access to the data, the ability to get it off and do something with it and then propagate it at the web. But this extra thing of being able to use probability theory to interpret it. You know, there's all Poisson distributions and all that kind of stuff hidden underneath, but that enabled you to actually interpret it as well. That stuff is really exciting, and there's going to be more and more of it. It's going to be cool.
Okay, is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
I think that's covered everything rather well.
Okay, then I have one silly,
all my hobby horses.
One silly question that I have to ask, yeah. for a different story that I'm doing in response to something that I talked to Alex Bellos about.
Oh, yeah.
So, do you have a favorite number?
Oh, God, then the favorite number. Oh, no. Oh, dear. Oh. No, I'm going to, oh, no. I don't, oh, God, I don't think I have. I mean, I love I.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think, I'm going to say I. You know, we're like complex numbers, aren't we?
Yeah,
good. I love I because it was someone telling me about that when I was at school. I was doing some extra maths, and they brought in some extra teachers, and he just started telling us about complex numbers when I was about 14, I suppose 15, and I thought this was the coolest thing. I'm getting almost tearful about it. It was. I am. God, I've never spoken, I've never ever talked about this before in 43 years or something like that. It made me realise that this was not only intellectually satisfying, but really exciting, and it absolutely determined that I was going to try to do maths. Yeah, and so I went on to do maths. And I really enjoyed complex analysis when at university. I've only used it once in my work since, sadly, but I did use it once in a paper. I absolutely loved it. It had that sort of mind-bending, mind-expanding, ludicrous nature, and yet done absolutely straight and rigorously, that has kept me really enjoying mathematical ideas since then. And the point is, although obviously something we haven't got on to, I mean, something, for example, I love this idea that also I believe is that probability doesn't exist, which I deeply believe. I teach it, I do it. It doesn't exist. It's not there at all. We made it up. It's all a construction. It's all a fiction. It's not there. You know, if you think it's there, show me how to measure it. You know, show me the ruler. Show me the probability thermometer. It's not there. It doesn't exist. We made it up. So I believe that. And I think it's lovely, you know, having all this lovely mathematical structure. Then you say, it's not there. It doesn't exist, you know. So I felt, as soon as I learned about I felt I'd been, you know, brought into this magical world which I've stayed in.
Well, thank you very much.
Extraordinary, yeah. We never talked about that. Really, ever. Yeah, great.